I reached out on Patreon to ask people what they thought I should do future episodes about, if there were any subjects that I was missing or that they think I should go into deeper. And a number of people thought it would be a good idea to discuss the technical interviews that I've done in the past and what other things I've learned from it and maybe a hilarious story or two. I'll do the hilarious stories in another episode, but this time I wanted to talk about the process of interviewing and what I learned from it over the years, and maybe it'll inspire people when they reach out for their documentaries or oral histories to ask that one question or go in that one direction that gives the future information that it vitally needs. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and keeping myself out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who are helping me stay out of debt. The fundamental idea behind an interview is to get information for some sort of final work. You could always just run the raw interview and leave things there, and many people do, but if you're going to make a documentary or an oral history and put together the questions and answers, what you want when you walk away is to have information that did not exist in the world before. Otherwise, you're just creating a puff piece, something people can read 100 times. When I was working on my technical documentaries, I was often interviewing people for whom there were no previous interviews to have to refer to, so I had a little bit of a leg up there. If I was asking a question, I may be the first time anybody has ever asked them that question on camera. I didn't have to worry about previous interviews and answers they had given over and over again. On the other hand, I was also interviewing people for whom they had no experience giving interviews, and many of them had built up some pretty strange ideas of how the interview would go. If you're out there and you're thinking about doing some sort of documentary or oral history work, well, first of all, let me say, it is very difficult, but it is so rewarding. So even though you may be nervous about your skills or the process or the time, trust me, your efforts will be rewarded. Also, it doesn't really matter how good the fidelity is on an interview if you look at things in the general sense. I mean, I was working on a cinematic set of interviews, interviews where I had people who were going to be on camera, where I was truly scared about the subject matter disappearing forever, so I wanted to build something in a cinematic language. That's the language I know and that I was trained in as a film major. So I needed a visual of people talking to go along with visuals of what they were talking about. There is no hard and set rule that says that that's what every interview has to be. It could end up being text on a page, it could end up being a podcast, an audio-only interview, it could be any of a number of formats. It doesn't have to be the best recorded or perfectly recorded item. I think everybody would agree that if you were interviewing somebody who was in a hospital or on their deathbed because they were the only person who knew a subject, we would be grateful as an audience to have any of the words that they had to say, regardless of buzzing, beeping, blurriness, or what have you. Information is king, and you being the person who took the time to get the information there, trust me, that's good enough. Maybe the next hardest part is getting in contact with people and tracking them down. There are so many easy ways to find names and where people live, and if you're doing certain services, even their phone numbers to reach them. Kevin Savitz, who's done tons of Atari interviews, used all sorts of methods to find people. He used people search archives. He would get old addresses. He would actually write paper letters to last known addresses telling them what he wanted and how to reach him. And you'd be surprised how relatively easy it is to track down people who are still alive, who did something way in the past, to figure out where they're living now, to track down a way to contact them, and to contact them. Maybe you're nervous about contacting people. I'll tell you that if a person is on the phone with you and you're telling them what you want to do and what project you're doing, being forthright and complimentary and indicating why you want to interview them, well, people are going to make a decision. And if the person says they don't want to do it or they need to think about it, being polite and being someone who's willing to walk away if it doesn't work out, that's all you need to be. You're not committing a crime. You're not being rude. You're saying to somebody, I personally think your voice and your information needs to be put into the record, and I would really appreciate it if you took some time to discuss these things with me. Well, who would walk away from that? I've been accused of being some sort of con artist or scammer by people I've contacted, and I just make an effort to give them a bunch of website names and to give them recordings of me talking about subjects and saying, hey, look at all these things, come back and we'll discuss it more if you're comfortable, and most do. In the modern era, it is so easy to conduct communications. You can do it from your home and have not just information about how to reach somebody, but have video and audio information about their past, about what they've worked on, to be able to discuss it with them. In many ways, research benefits you immensely. Let's get some terms out of the way. There's the interview, which is where you sit down either in person or over the phone or through communication technologies with somebody. That's the interview itself. But there's something called the pre-interview and sometimes the post-interview. The pre-interview is a usually not recorded informal event where you talk with somebody about subjects you're going to be going into, to give them time to think about their answers and maybe to look things up or to verify what they said. Obviously, you don't always get the luxury of a pre-interview, but as somebody who has gone through it myself, I find it incredibly helpful. You might remember that something happened in 1983, but it turns out it's 1984. You might think something cost $400, but it turns out it was $200. And these are the kind of things you can look up before you do your actual interview and which certain people will want to know. One of the things that I would do when I conducted an interview, of course, would be to look up the facts a person said. And if they got it wrong, well, no foul. I would just take it out of the final edited work. It was more important to say something was very expensive than to have somebody exactly give how much it cost on a given date. People don't need to do the job of web pages. But that pre-interview doesn't just let them look up facts. It also gives them an idea of the subjects you're going into, and maybe they'll even start to think of some other ideas of what the actual interview can cover. They might even give you, at that point, the names of people you should look up and research about, because they'll know things without knowing it's important. So many times I've talked to somebody and right at the end they'll say, hey, you know, I was part of a company before the company you're interviewing me about. Have you talked to anybody from that group? And I'll say, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. And next thing you know, I have two or three interviews in the can from people I would have never thought to contact. And it really doesn't hurt for those other folks to say, I've already interviewed this person and he said you should be interviewed as well. By the time I got past 100 interviews with the BBS documentary, it was relatively trivial to have a skeptical person go to the website, look at pictures I took during the interviews, and prove to them that I was both legitimate and to prove that there was a pretty astounding set of folks that they themselves could be a part of. So let's move forward to the interview. You've agreed to meet with somebody at a certain time, and you should definitely be there on time. And you start the recorder immediately, as soon as you get there, in any way that you can. Just start recording, because people have a habit of freezing up. You say, okay, I'm going to begin the recording, and you carefully walk over, and you press the button. And the fact is I have watched folks lose 30% of their personality because they think, now I'm on the air. And people aren't on the air anymore. Through editing technology and being able to do all sorts of post-production, we have so much leeway to work with what comes out. People should not freeze up, but they do. In the same way, by the way, I don't rush to turn off the recorder either. People will finish what they think is the main part of the interview, and then we'll just informally discuss some other ideas. And they're under no pressure, and I'm certainly not trying to fool them. But they'll say, okay, actually, you know, there's this other stuff that's not important, but they'll go into it anyway because to them it's tangential. But it'll turn out in the aggregate to be incredibly important to what you're interviewing them. I mean, a person who I interviewed who was talking to me about all sorts of things with their game company suddenly at the end starts talking about another company that tried to buy them and why it didn't work out. And I ended up having that footage be meaningful in history, even if I didn't use it in a specific documentary. Footage is footage. Words are words. There's been a lot written on how to do interviews. I've read a lot of the how-to guides, and a lot of them are just trying to get you to not freeze up the interviewee. You don't want to interrupt them. You don't want to talk over them. If you can, you should avoid correcting them unless there's a way to gently move the conversation into a direction. I mean, if a person says this never happened and you know because you've done the research that they have, you might want to think about coming up with questions that say, well, some people call it this. What's their problem? And then finding out what their opinion is about, quote unquote, the wrong thing, even though you know it's the right thing. You're in a partnership with this person. They're not some sort of toy that you're trying to get the most out of. I've been very lucky. My interviews tend to not be hostile. I'm not in it like a person is a locked box that I have to pick to get the information out that they're completely loath to give to me. People are either forgetful or don't know something is important, but they all pretty much want to help tell the real story about why something happened, why they did something, what ended up happening because of it, and the information that may or may not be out there. People have variant memories. You can even find it yourself. You might say to yourself, when did this happen? And then look it up in your notes or in history and discover you're completely off. I do it. Most everyone does it. There are a few exceptions, but they are very much that, exceptions. In terms of technical interviews, interviews with technical people working in engineering or science, there's an exacting life they have lived. There is information that has to be correct, or something shorts out or explodes or doesn't work. So that personality type does not like going into areas they're not comfortable with, or technical conclusions that could be misleading or dangerous. So it's always important, if you can, to ask questions of a general nature and let them go into detail where they're comfortable. Even though you, the interviewer, know that the interviewee was right next to the desk of the person who did this, to the interviewee, that's a whole other world and they won't know anything about it. Oh, another thing. Listening. You see, it's possible to go in with your 10 special questions, the ones that you need to get out there, and walk in, hammer the person with 10 questions, turn off the recorder, and walk out. This is ridiculous. If you're working for a production company that has a very tight budget and will not allow you to stay one more minute or ask one more question, that's a whole different situation. But I'm assuming you're just a person who wants to tell a story and get the story right. If that's the case, please don't let yourself be limited to some sort of set of ideas that if the person doesn't answer them, you have failed. There have been times that I've walked into interviews with somebody who has the knowledge about one specific software package, and I never got to the software package because their thoughts on the general industry they were in were much more valuable. They were going in that direction. I would try to tell them, could you tell me a little more about this program that you're famous for? And they would say, yeah, I mean, I worked on it. I was really proud of it. But I remember the most when I took it to a convention and here are the people I met. And suddenly you realize they've been going on for 5 minutes about the convention. They never mentioned their software once. But you know what? That convention information was gold. follow-up questions are critical. You listen to what they're saying, and you find out that they have an idea in their head that they maybe haven't quite gotten out. Maybe in describing what they were doing with a program, they mention, as an aside, how hard it was to get to work, and that's why they left. And what you might not know is nobody's ever known why that person left that company at such a great time. And if you ask follow-up questions about how hard was it to get to work, and then they say, well, yeah, because that's why I left. You say, oh, how did you feel about leaving? Or, oh, I didn't know that's why you left. The person will then go into a line of answers that weren't on your little sheet of questions and yet give so much important information to the future. I can't stress it enough. A good interview is like a song. The interviewer asks the question and gives the line. The interviewee answers the line. The interviewer listens to what the interviewee is doing, and they switch over to a different line. And you follow together, going down a path that neither of you might have thought of doing. And it might turn out that even though you thought you were speaking to the world expert on subject A, you were actually speaking to the world expert on subjects B, C, and D. So, as I've said before, I was only really able to do 4 interviews maximum during one single day. I actually fell asleep during the 4th interview. So, it's something that you want to pace out if you have the luxury to do so. If you're interviewing a number of people, it's kind of important, if you can, to get an interview with people separately. But if they're known for working with others, there's actually a beautiful moment that you can get if you bring these people together for a second interview or an interview later that day after a lunch, and the people will feed off of each other. I've seen this more than once where a person will say something and somebody else will go, no, that's not how it worked, or, oh, but you didn't even mention this, or a million other little back and forth that they're just magical moments to watch old friends or old colleagues or experts in the same subject treat each other as different components of a puzzle. I also mentioned post-interviews. I've had cases where you talk to people a little while later and they'll say something like, I didn't cover this subject and I feel we should really go back and cover it. And maybe it's just a matter of writing a few paragraphs to you so you understand what you didn't get. In other cases, I've had people put conditions or attempt to put conditions on their interviews. Could you please not include this part? It occurs to me that that's still under wraps and I really shouldn't have mentioned it now. And you'll say, okay, I'll keep that under wraps. Is there a time when I could make it maybe not under wraps? And discuss that with them. It's a way of respecting the interviewee, making them understand that they weren't taken advantage of, that you didn't violate their trust for some sort of short-term gain. Building up these relationships is important. Having people who you discuss things with years after your interview. I've had friendships and collaborators and all sorts of people who are in my life now because of interviews we did 5, 10, 15 years ago. Don't treat the moment that you turn off the recorder as the end of your interaction with that person. That is very rarely the case. As for the final work that you're doing this all for, it's okay just to have it be a series of interviews that are transcribed or even left as MP3s and put up on a server somewhere. It's okay. It's raw material, material that did not exist in the world before you. And maybe you'll do something with it or somebody else will do something with it. I have old cassette tapes that are representative of the only known interviews with people who are long gone. And if the people hadn't sat down and pressed record on that tape, there would be no record of that person in their own words. Maybe you're thinking of writing some sort of book. Maybe you want to turn this all into some sort of movie. Maybe it becomes a newspaper article or a research article. Maybe you're just somebody who's going to be cited by others when they're trying to do the final story of whatever subjects you touched on. I don't think that's overly important. I don't like approaching things on a pure commodity sale approach. I'm going to interview the 50 people who created this subject, and I am going to turn it into a product about that subject that will make me money. It's nice to make money. It's certainly wonderful to have spending money because you worked on something and you were rewarded with cash. But I think if that 100% drives you, a number of pitfalls hit you at the end. You end up setting unrealistic expectations and metrics for yourself. You want to make this amount of money for the amount it cost you to work on it. You want to have this level of audience. You want this amount of feedback. And we don't always get what makes sense. Besides the documentaries, there are other works I have done that people have come to me a decade later and said, "Man, I am so glad that you did this because nobody else had done it at the time." The most striking example was simply transcribing the crack screens of Apple II pirates. That has put me in touch with more historical figures and won over more people to projects I'm currently working on than almost anything else I've done. And it was a whim, and it was not a product. It'll never be a product, and I'll keep that thing up forever. So I don't know how many of you will now go forward with interviews and oral histories, but I would really love to hear if you did, if there's something you want to find more research about and you want to interview folks about it and build something, a list of MP3 files, a set of Medium posts, some sort of text file collection, something, because I promise you, as much as you think a lot of people must have been interviewed in the past, it's almost never the case. You have a number of folks who are famous for something, and they are interviewed a lot about the same subjects. And then one desk over, one house over, one position over is somebody with even more information who will never see the light of day. Those folks are waiting for your call. And they want to tell you some amazing stories. This is Jason Scott, Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Mark Pilgrim, Adam Green, James Bekoyanu, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me stay out of debt.